peace. I didn't know that was going to happen, but she just has this real peace about her that she can go into these horrible situations and talk to the mother of the kid who's just been killed in a car accident, or go to these suicide scenes and talk to people. And the police in the city that she lives call her when they've had one of these situations and say, "Nanette, would you come?" And she will go and just kind of hold a place, you know, for these people. So anyways, she wrote me this note, just an email out of the blue. And it says, "Hi, Kenny. Once a month, we have a mandatory TIP continuing education class for 4 hours. And last night, our speaker was from a police unit that had just put together a really remarkable film on the meth epidemic here. Several police officers had done this on their own, and now it's getting accolades everywhere. In one segment, they showed mugshots of quite a few meth addicts who had all agreed to be filmed, with the mugshots at different times and different arrests. You could see the huge difference in their looks in a matter of a few months or a few years. One of the men they showed somehow reminded me of you, Kenny. He was handsome and had eyes that showed just incredible sadness. And his pictures, over a period of several years, got progressively worse and worse. In the last picture of him, he looked so much like you did when you were trying so hard to kick heroin at my house here in Vancouver. When Jeff brought you over that night, I would not have recognized you, and it was all I could do not to sob right in front of you. The man in the film looked just like that. Haunted eyes, sunken face, stooped posture, hopelessness. I prayed all the way home in gratitude. I don't think I've ever completely told you of how much I love God, even if it was for only one thing, bringing my son back home to me and giving him life and sustaining him. I know this isn't the best venue to tell you how I'm feeling, but I didn't want to wait until I see you again. I just want you to know that I'm grateful that you came to me that night, and that somewhere and somehow along the way after that, you found God." So that's like the dramatic difference, you know, in my life, from showing up at my mom's place and forcing this woman to start saving for my funeral to where I'm at in my life today. I don't know, I just felt compelled to read that now, and I'm glad I did. I am now actually going to crack the big book, which is one of the reasons why we're here. And I'm not going to try to read too much directly out of the big book. I don't want to just read the big book to you. I just do want to get an idea of who I'm talking to. And this group, it's unfortunate, this group is too large. I'd like to go around and just kind of give everybody a minute or two. But if we did that, we'd be here for the next 2 hours without getting around the room. So we're just going to shorten the version a little bit. So how many people are here tonight that have been through the 12 steps and are actually working with others now? So that's a majority. That's really great that we've got that here for the weekend. And how many people are in the steps currently and not the people that have already raised your hands? How many people that didn't already raise their hands are here and are currently working the steps with a sponsor? And then how many people are here that have not begun the process of working the steps yet? Well, very good. So, and that kind of gives me an idea how we can proceed here too. So I'm not going to do too much like direct reading the big book to you this weekend. We can save that. It would appear that the majority of the people here have already done that. And if they haven't, they've got sponsors that are taking them through that process right now. So there's a really good core here in Santa Fe. There's a great core with that Monday night meeting. And if I had this to do over again and I actually thought about this, I would switch it up and I would come on a Friday and stay till a Monday and go home on a Tuesday so that I could come to your Monday night group. And someday I will. I'll make a point of coming because I just hear great things. There was a group of people that came over to Tom and Juanita's house and had a little potluck on Thursday night, and they shared with me the format of the meeting. And so you've really got this great base of recovery. So for most of us, we're going to be kind of going through this retreat process that we talk about. But I'm going to leave it all in simple enough terms that this retreat would help, or this set of tapes will help anybody that goes through this. I will tell you that if I was sponsoring you, just to get this out front, what we would do is we would meet once a week and we would meet for an hour and a half, and I would read the book to you, and we would start at that title page. We'd start off with we wouldn't be using this retreat prayer. We'd be using a prayer that I use called the set-aside prayer that I think several of you know, but it's that's not terribly important. We start with a prayer. I give them a few things that they can kind of use in their life, and we start with the three legacies of AA, of unity, service, and recovery, and a prayer, and we start going forward. We look at all the forwards, and we just kind of do this deal where we have had this idea that the solution for alcoholism is contained in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, that if you want to know about Alcoholics Anonymous, you read the book. And I will take people through that book the same way that group of people in that workshop took me through that book. And we're going to go through it just one paragraph at a time. If there's a word we don't understand, we're going to look it up in the dictionary. We use pens and highlighters, so we're people that color in our books. And we make sure that we not only do we look at that, but we do everything that it says all the way along. And the people that wrote this book had these experiences, you know, these experiences where they say, you know, the great truth is just this and nothing less, that we've had these experiences that have revolutionized our whole attitude and outlook upon life, and they say they've been rocketed into a fourth dimension of which we'd not even dreamed, and you know, we can recreate that experience. They've left this book that shows us precisely how they have recovered, and one of the things that I've really come to believe, doesn't matter where you're at in the literature, it doesn't really even matter, I don't think, what 12-step fellowship that you're in. And I do carry this message to people that whether it's AA or Al-Anon or NA or one of any of the other 12-step recovery groups, I think you should be interested in where that came from. And this book that we're looking at this weekend, this is the grandmother of all 12-step programs. There was not 12 steps before Bill sat in his kitchen and wrote the 12 steps out, and they were published in this book for the first time in history. So you should be interested in that, regardless of what other literature is out there, to come back to this core deal where they say, we're going to show you precisely how we have recovered. And these are people who found permanent sobriety. And so if you're interested in that, you know, the idea is that you go through this book paragraph by paragraph and you do everything that it says. And it's a big book do instead of a big book study. And you do everything that the book says all the way along. So when it gets to the third step, we do a third step. And when it gets to inventory, we do inventory. So that's what will happen if I sponsor you. Here this weekend, it's going to be different. We're going to have to kind of, digest some big chunks along the way rather quickly. So we're going to do that starting in the first step. And there's a couple of things that we'll look at. The first thing that I think we'll look at, we'll just jump right up into the doctor's opinion. And, you know, we're leaving behind the forwards to the first edition, the circle and triangle. And we're doing that kind of intentionally. We're doing that strictly for the amount of time that we have and kind of the place that this group is at, too. I'm in a third edition here, and I should have brought a fourth edition so I had the right page number, but I think there's only one page difference. So in the third edition, I'm at 26, page 26 in Roman numerals. In the third edition, for those of you that have your books and want to follow along, you can. I think it would be 27 in the fourth edition, and that's the bottom paragraph says, men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. The doctor's opinion had some great things about it. It was written in two different letters. And the first letter, the history of AA tells us, was written by Dr. Silkworth. And if you go back and read that, and I'm just putting this in context, this paragraph, if you go back and read that, it's pretty light stuff. It's kind of, yeah, these guys did, you can rely on what they have to say. And it's, you know, it's almost an endorsement, but not completely. And, you know, these guys had an experience. If you go back and look at the forward to the second edition, one of the big things that happened for both of these guys was this doctor's opinion had a huge effect on Bill Wilson. And Bill Wilson went down and was talking with a guy, Dr. Bob, who had repeatedly tried spiritual means to solve his alcoholic dilemma but had failed. So this guy knew what the answer was. He knew that the answer was in the spiritual life. He was with a group of people that made amends and admitted their shortcomings and believed in helpfulness to others and dependency on God. He was with a group of people like that before, but he couldn't stay sober until Bill gave him Dr. Silkworth's description of alcoholism and its hopelessness. He got that hopelessness, and that's really what our first step is. You know, people have known what the answer was for a long time, but Dr. Silkworth just was a guy that was able to put the problem in these concise terms. And after he wrote that first letter, which was just a little short of one page, they said, come on, Silky, you know, we know you're holding out on us here. And he was. He was a little reluctant to endorse the spiritual way of life because he was a very prominent, well-known doctor in his field of treating alcoholics and drug addicts. And he did not feel comfortable in exposing himself to saying, hey, there's a certain type of alcoholic that we really can't help. We don't even know what to do with these people. And the answer is probably a spiritual answer. But when he wrote this second letter, he really let it fly. And he just laid it all out there that you know, these are people who need an entire psychic change, and there's very little hope of their recovery. And he goes on to say that, you know, these powers of good that lie outside our synthetic knowledge, and that this solution must come from a power greater than themselves. And if they are to recreate their lives, he uses this language in here that's very powerful spiritual language coming from a doctor of his time. And then he goes on to say in there that he clarifies it for a minute. He kind of catches himself in this letter, and he says, hey, if any of you guys are wondering why I'm endorsing this deal, you know, why don't you, I'd like to use different words, but, you know, why don't you come down here to Towns Hospital and see the despairing children and the sad wives and the hopeless condition and you know, that I deal with in my every single day and even in my sleeping moments. Come down here to Towns Hospital sometime in New York City if you don't like the fact that I'm endorsing the spiritual answer. So that's kind of the shortness of the doctor's opinion, but it's kind of like a synopsis, but I think if we were to really draw it down even to a shorter thing than that, it would be this one paragraph. This one paragraph, I really think, is the doctor's opinion in a nutshell. That one paragraph, if you were to like pick like a singleness of purpose that he had and you only could pick out one paragraph, it would be this. This was the doctor's opinion. Men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. The sensation is so elusive that while they admit it is injurious, they cannot, after a time, differentiate the truth from the false. To them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. They are restless, irritable, and discontent until they can again experience a sense of ease and comfort, which comes at once by taking a few drinks. Drinks which they see others taking with impunity after they have succumbed to the desire again, as so many do, and the phenomenon of craving develops. They pass through the well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful with a firm resolution not to drink again. This is repeated over and over, and unless this person can experience an entire psychic change, there is very little hope of his recovery. I really think that's kind of the doctor's opinion in a nutshell. All of the rest of what he's doing is brought to a place where he can format that one paragraph. And this paragraph, the first time I read that, and I'm reading it tonight in case there's anybody that maybe hasn't completely diagnosed themselves, to realize that if I was doing this work with you, it'd be over a process of several weeks that we would do this. But, you know, that is it in a nutshell. You know, if that describes you, and it described me perfectly what was going on with me, that when I was sober, I was restless, irritable, and discontent. That eventually sober, I would succumb to the desire for a drink. And for me, sometimes, you know, it would take weeks or months. I've had the experience with a lot of people in AA that this process took years before they got to that succumb to the desire for a drink. Once I take a drink, then I break out in this phenomenon of craving, which is what I talked about in my talk, that this compulsion for more becomes paramount to anything else. That I'm not drinking to have a good time anymore, I'm drinking to overcome a compulsion for more. That's the phenomenon of craving. If when you put some in, you break out in a craving for more, you might be an alcoholic. That's what the book says. And it says that we emerge from this deal remorseful. Like that first time that I had a drink, and over and over and over and over again, I emerged remorseful. And then it said the scary part. It said that we emerge from that with this firm resolution never to drink again. And it said, this is repeated over and over. And I know when I read that and I was in that workshop, you know, I knew I was going to drink again. And this kind of told me that. It was like, it was almost, there was something about this that out of that hopelessness was born hope. Because I knew it, and then here it was in the book. And that I knew that maybe AA wasn't, I thought AA was kind of for people who could stop drinking. It was kind of a club where people who didn't drink could get together. And I just didn't ever fit in because my problem was I couldn't stop drinking. I couldn't stop no matter what I would drink. And this told me the deal that I realized that I was one more time with all that help from Al and all the help from the people down at the club, that one more time I was in a firm resolution not to drink again. And the scary thing about being in a firm resolution that I'll never take another drink is that this is repeated over and over is the next sentence. And unless a person experiences an entire psychic change, that's what the 12 steps bring about. Psychic is the mind. This is a psychiatrist that was writing this, so I'm quite sure of the particular definition that he meant by that. Psychic is the mind. You know, unless I have a completely change in the way of my thinking, I will return to drinking. I think that's what he's saying here. And so I kind of got that. I kind of got that hopelessness. And that's the same thing that Dr. Bob got. Dr. Bob understood for the first time that firm resolution never to drink again didn't mean anything when it came to a real alcoholic. That he had those firm resolutions all the time, and that it was repeated over and over again. And then I'm going to point out just a couple things in Bill's story, starting on page 5. There's a deal in Bill's story, and it says, and I looked at Bill, and I think you guys, there's kind of a common thing that we do in the big book in our circle, and that's that when I have somebody look at Bill's story, those first 8 pages of Bill's story, which is, Bill's story is 16 pages. There's 8 pages of his drinking and 8 pages of him sober. And I don't know if that was coincidence or not, but I think it's kind of, it's just a really neat way to realize that half of his story is about recovery. And I mentioned that in my talk, I think, tonight, how grateful I am that I actually have this part of my story now about what happened and what it's like now, that I had an experience with these steps and that this is what my life is like now. That's the what happened. And Bill was the same way. But those first 8 pages are his drinking. So I usually have people go through and underline everything of how I felt, thought, drank, and used compared to Bill's story. And when I did that, I kind of came up with Kenny's story. I mean, I had all this stuff underlined, and things just started coming to life. And, Bill was a stockbroker in New York City. He was a married guy. He still had a house, although I think he was getting ready to lose everything. But, he still had a house. And, he still had there wasn't much game left. But, he went, when he's talking about going to wars, he was talking about World War I. I just didn't think I'd ever really relate to this guy. And I started really looking at his story from that place of the hopelessness in the doctor's opinion. And I just fell in love with Bill. And I'm still that way today. I'm in love with the first 8 pages of Bill's story because of the hopelessness that man felt. And and the miracle that this was the guy who founded AA. And you don't have to wait for this deal. You don't have to wait to be sober a long time to get this deal. You just that little coming from that place of hopelessness to this place of recovery is a pretty quick deal. Clint talks about one day I was drinking and the next day I was sober. And he says, man, that's moving right along if you ask me. Here's this deal on page 5. It said, I woke up. This had to be stopped. I saw I could not take so much as one drink. I was through forever. Before then, I had written lots of sweet promises, but my wife happily observed that this time I meant business, and so I did. So here's this guy who was an alcoholic who can't stop drinking. He's been in and out of the hospital several times. His wife's heard it. How many times did Lois probably hear that I'll never drink again? I mean, how many times? Uh-huh. I think we could say it was dozens, maybe more. Maybe it was hundreds, I don't know, but it was probably at least dozens. But something happened this time to Bill. It was different this time. Happily, my wife observed that this time I meant business. You know, this is a guy that said that he, firm resolution, I'm not ever going to drink again, and I mean it this time. And his Lois says, oh my God, finally he means it. He's really going to quit drinking this time. What a great thing. You know, I can see it in Bill that he means this deal. And he goes on to and I'll tell you one more thing. I actually had an opportunity a couple years ago to go back to Akron, Ohio. And in the inner group in Akron, Ohio, in the inner group office, they have an unbelievable archives there in the inner group in Akron, if you ever get the opportunity. I've seen the archives in New York at Central Office, and I'm not making a judgment which one's better or anything, but they're both amazing, but that Akron office really had the bigger impact on me. They have a copy of Bill Wilson's family Bible at the Akron Inner Group. And in his Bible, there was a deal in, I'm losing the word for a second, but what was the prohibition? You know, in Prohibition, there was kind of a popular movement of what they called taking the pledge. You know, the Washingtonians would take the pledge, and they had 100,000 sober at one time. And, you know, it was kind of but even after the Washingtonians, that still was kind of a popular way to do it. You would say, I'm not ever going to drink again so long as I live. And you would write in the Bible, and you would sign it in your family Bible. That was, you know, and if you did that, well, of course, you'd never drink again. And so, you know, I saw that in the Akron Inner Group, this copy of Bill Wilson's family Bible. I promise I will never take another drink so long as I live, Bill Wilson. And then it hit me. I knew what this meant. I had written lots of sweet promises. He had written lots of sweet promises in his Bible. And the thing about that Bible that's at the Akron Inner Group is Bill wrote that more than once in his Bible. And, you know, I related to that desperate place that he must have been. But this was different than those sweet promises. It was different than when he signed the Bible and took the pledge. Something was different this time. He really meant it. He really meant it. And then what's the next line in the book? Shortly afterward, I came home drunk. And you know, I loved Bill Wilson from the moment I read that. Because that's where I was at. And I didn't really know that that's what AA was about. I really didn't. I didn't know that AA was for this hopeless type alcoholic, this person that can't quit. And this is Bill Wilson trying willpower. He had plenty of willpower. You know, I know what that's like to make the decision to stop and really want to and go through all those withdrawals and go through all that torture and all that stuff and you know, get the family all, and then to not make it. And to just think, like, what is wrong with me? You know, I really wanted to. I can't believe I'm back here. That deal with pounding on the bar. So here's that deal with the, that was self-will. And there's a couple other things that don't work. Didn't work for me, and they didn't work for Bill either. The second one is on page 7. This is Bill going into treatment, learning all about alcoholism, and you know, he had this brother-in-law that was a physician, Lois's brother, and he was able to kind of pull some strings. That's how Bill got into Towns Hospital so many times, was his brother. His brother-in-law would kind of pull a few strings and get Bill in over there and pay for it. Towns Hospital was not a free deal far from a free deal. It was for people, you know, you had to pay to go there, and they'd detox and bring you off the booze. And it says, you know, here's Bill coming out of treatment. And it said, it relieved me somewhat to learn that in alcoholics, the will is amazingly weakened when it comes to liquor combating, though it often remains strong in other respects. My incredible behavior in the face of a desperate desire to stop was explained. He knew how come self-knowledge wasn't going to work. He knew that now. He said, understanding myself now, I fared forth in high hope. For 3 or 4 months, the goose hung high. And I have no idea what that means. I know it means that, you know, for 3 or 4 months, everything went great and he was getting money and stuff. But I don't know what that means, to hang the goose high. So somebody can tell me sometime if they what that expression means. I went to town regularly and even made a little money. Surely this was the answer, self-knowledge. This time I know I've got the knowledge of why the self-knowledge won't fail. I've learned all about alcoholism, and I've been through this treatment. So, and again, the next sentence in the book. But it was not, for the frightful day came when I drank once more. And you know, that was just that deal. Then I said, well, self-knowledge isn't going to work. And I was a guy that knew a lot about alcoholism. I'd been to treatment centers. There's a book called Under the Influence by Dr. Milam. There's a huge treatment center out on the West Coast called Milam Treatment Center. And it's a fantastic book. And I went into a treatment center where that was the main deal, was reading Dr. Milam's Under the Influence. And I learned all about the synapses and the brains. And I probably, you get some of this stuff mixed up. It's been years ago and I didn't stay sober, so I probably wasn't. I'm probably not a good person to be quoting this, but it had all the little deals about the receptors and how after a while they get kind of separated and they don't shoot the spark quite right, and how those things got to mend and all this stuff. And it was that same deal, the self-knowledge. I mean, I was loaded with knowledge about alcoholism. And that was a treatment center, and I had the same deal. I actually got drunk the day I got out of that treatment center. The day I got out, I got drunk. But it wasn't for the frightful day came, so the self-knowledge didn't work for me. And I had that same experience. Self-knowledge had failed me. Self-will had failed me. And Bill tries one more thing over on page 8. Trembling, I stepped from the hospital a broken man. Fear sobered me for a bit. Then came the insidious insanity of that first drink. Fear sobered me for a bit. And I could tell you when I was at my mother's house there, which was months before I quit, found that AA meeting and was given the gift of sobriety. I could tell you a story being there where I had hepatitis for one thing, so I was really sick. And so I was kind of yellow colored and I couldn't eat. I had no energy at all. I was back and forth to the hospitals. And during that time, I'd got a little money at some point, and I went to a bar, and I got in a fight in this bar, and a guy totally beat the crap out of me, and he broke my eye socket bone, my cheekbone, my jaw was broke, and I had to have surgery on my left eye. And so then I was yellow, but then my face was all puffed out, and I was, you know, my eye had surgery, so I had, you know, it was all full of blood, and I'm living, you know, 28 years old, living at my mom's house in that condition. And I still couldn't stop. I still was drinking and drugging in that condition every time I possibly could. And I think about that, and I think about, well, maybe if I could just remember how bad that was, that I won't ever have to go back to it. Maybe if I just remember how bad it was, I won't ever have to go back to that. But I've had that experience that, you know, fear won't work for a real alcoholic. Because a real alcoholic, I have this mind of the alcoholic that's described in a little more and more about alcoholism. And there is a solution. I have this mind of the alcoholic. And the way that mind works is that if that thought was to even cross my mind, it would be vague. It would be almost like it happened to somebody else. Maybe not today, but the time and date would come when that will fail me, remembering how bad it was. It will be, you know, I got to a place where, remember I talked about drinking that bottle of wine real fast? Well, later on in my drinking, many years later, I kind of came back to that. I would buy really cheap wine because it was cheap and affordable. And I had this deal where I could drink a bottle of wine really fast, like take big, big, big pulls off this bottle of wine. And it would just, whew, just relax. It would just calmness. And I wouldn't even have to wait till that alcohol hit my brain. I would just be at a place where I would just be, just the warmness going down my throat and the warmness in my belly of that cheap wine, the way that would feel. And I can even remember what it felt like when I exhaled and all that alcohol would be evaporating. And I would just that feeling and just, I would just be like, you know, and it was like that ease and comfort that comes at once by taking a few drinks. You know, I had that ease and comfort. And the problem is that, you know, when suffering from the mind of the alcoholic, because I got this horrible situation that I remember at my mother's house, and then I've got this other thing, this ease and comfort that comes at once by taking a few drinks. And I know as an alcoholic, without a real answer, without a complete psychic change, the time and day will come when I am only going to remember that ease and comfort. And if I remember this other deal at all, it's just going to be this vague, hazy deal, like maybe somehow it won't hurt me this time. So we're going to go just a few more minutes here. But we do have a mic up here we can turn on. And so is there any questions to answer? We'll kind of talk a little bit more about the first step maybe here. We'll talk a little bit about the second step and kind of set the format for tomorrow. And then we're just going to break off and have some fun for the night. It's 9:30. I think probably most people work today and have had long days. And we won't keep people here. But is there any questions and answers or comments? Okay. We do have a mic here. The reason that we have the mic is for the benefit of the people who might listen to these CDs that he's making. It's really hard to do the question and answer format without that. So, but don't let that make you nervous. I'm going to continue to ask that question. If you have questions or comments about the material that we've covered, I would really encourage you to ask about it. So, once we've established in the first step that we are hopeless aside from a spiritual experience, there's a deal in More About Alcoholism. And I'll get to page number here in just a second. And actually, I think it's 45. I think it's the first page of We Agnostics, 44. The first paragraph, we go through all through. There is a solution. Then we go to More About Alcoholism. And in More About Alcoholism, they really tell us these stories of these guys. And actually, one of these stories is in There is a Solution. But they tell us the story of these guys. They tell us the story of Fred. They tell us the story of Jim. They tell us the story of the certain American businessman. They tell us the story of a man of about 30 or so. And there's one more story in there, and it's an analogy about a jaywalker that they try to tell us that isn't all the rest of these stories the same as a guy who just gets a thrill out of skipping in front of fast-moving vehicles. These people all have something in common. They all have something in common, and what they have in common is this. They all had exposure to the founders of Alcoholics Anonymous, the early members. They had all made a start, but had failed to enlarge on their spiritual life. They'd all been given this message that Dr. Bob had, that, you know, we've got this opinion, this doctor's opinion, and this phenomenon of craving, and that, you know, it takes a spiritual experience to recover. And these are guys that made a start or made a beginning or something in AA. And then they ended up drinking again after having self-knowledge, self-will, and fear fail them. They're people that came to AA and did some of the work that's necessary to have a spiritual experience. They all have that same thing in common. The jaywalker finally runs in front of a fire truck and gets his back broken. But the analogy is the same. This analogy is that we do these things sober, that in our sober life we get restless, irritable, and discontent. I just had a phone call the day before I came here from a guy who's 30 years sober and has relapsed. 30 years sober. And he called me. And he, you know what he told me? He told me he's been in the program saying he was sober, and he hasn't been sober for 7 years. Yeah. Can you imagine what that would be like? And you know what I told him? I told him, you know what, brother, this could be me, and this phone call could be the other way around. And man, I'm so glad that you called. You know, I might need you to be there for me someday. He got restless, irritable, and discontent, sober. He didn't enlarge on his spiritual life, and it took a little longer than it took for these four people, but he had the same thing. And the book is perfect. There's a speaker that says this, and I don't know if it's his deal, but I will attribute it to him, just in that, you know, it's not from me. And he says about the perfectness of the big book. And I really believe this book is just absolutely perfect for the alcoholic. You know, it just, doesn't need to be changed, and it's just a perfect thing. What he says about this is he says that this is the first time in the history of the planet that we've had this concise, precise way written out on how an alcoholic gets from that place of that hopelessness that Bill was in to this place of a useful and happy recovered life. It's just right there, written there, and it's just absolutely perfect. And there's another speaker that says that, you know, Bill was 3.5 years sober when he wrote this stuff. He was 4 years sober when the book was published. But, you know, he wrote our 12 steps 3.5 years sober, sat down at his kitchen table and wrote the 12 steps and said he did it in 30 minutes. And the reason that I believe that it was really a divinely inspired deal, and I love the analogy that Bill only held the pen. You know, he was a vehicle. And I feel that same way, that years later they realized that, and that's part and parcel where our 12th tradition comes from. Anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all of these traditions. And what that means is that, you know, when I'm sitting working with a newcomer, if my head is in the right place, I'm completely anonymous in that process. And I think that's the way Bill was. Bill held the pen. And the reason I believe that is, and this speaker says the same thing, he says that I've been 3.5 years sober, and you don't know these things when you're 3.5 years sober. That's how he knows that Bill didn't write this himself. And I like that. He didn't know these things. And, you know, he wrote something that was far beyond his actual experience. And I love this paragraph in We Agnostics. After they give us all this stuff, and they really hammer us on the first step over and over and over again. And Bill has this way of writing, and someday somebody will coin a term for this, and maybe it's already been, but he has this way of writing where he tells you what he's going to tell you. Then he tells you what he's going to tell you. And then he tells you what he just told you. And, you know, and that's the reason he put Fred and Jim. And you know, that he even has a tricky part in there. If you'll read this, he says, our first example is a friend we'll call Jim. Well, didn't we just look at the man of 30 or so just right before that? And didn't we just look at Bill's story before that? And in the second, to forward to the second edition, you got some stuff about doctor. I mean, there's a whole bunch of them. But then he comes back, well, our first example is just, and he just hammers us with this stuff. And then in We Agnostics, he ends up coming back to this idea of the first step for the last time in the book. And it's not the last time in the book. Actually, the last time in the book, he wraps it up. He brings us right back to that hopelessness of alcoholism in A Vision for You, in a beautiful way. In the first couple paragraphs of A Vision for You, he brings it back to us. But he leaves it aside for a good part of the rest of the book now. But he brings us all back to these same things again. And that's this first paragraph on page 44. In the preceding chapters, you have learned something of alcoholism. We hope we have made clear the distinction between the alcoholic and the non-alcoholic. And this is why I say this is perfect. If, when you honestly want to, you find you cannot quit entirely. He's not telling you one thing. He's just saying if that's the way it is. He's just sticking to his own experience. And I've really learned that's what we need to do around here. Just stick to our own experience. I'm here to tell you what my experience is. I got no idea if anybody else in this room is an alcoholic or not, or anybody that I sponsor is or not. My job is to help them find that out by reading this book to them and sharing what my experience was. But he uses those words, if, when you honestly want to. And I did. I said, well, yeah, when I honestly want to, I couldn't quit entirely because I had that same experience of, you know, this time they knew I'm in business. And it says, or if when drinking you have little control over the amount you take, once I take a drink, do I break out in this phenomenon of craving or not? If when drinking you have little control over the amount you take, he says you are probably alcoholic. It's a self-diagnosis deal. You know, some people say that this alcoholism is the only disease where the patient has to diagnose themselves. You know, there's nobody that can tell you're alcoholic or not. It's something you got to come to on your own. And it's a good thing to revisit in these retreats is to revisit this idea of, am I an alcoholic? Let me look at my experience. Yeah, well, when I honestly wanted to, could I quit? If when drinking, did I have little control over the amount? It says you're probably alcoholic. Okay, well, probably I'm an alcoholic. Then it says, if that be the case, you may be suffering from an illness which only a spiritual experience will conquer. You may be suffering from that. Only a spiritual experience will conquer. Well, how do I know? Well, I knew because everything else in my life had failed. And I kind of still come from a school of thought, I think, that, and this is coming from a guy, again, that's been wrong about most everything, but I still come from a school of thought where I really think if you got other options available to him, you probably ought to go try them first, because you're probably not going to, if there's anything else available to you, you're probably, my experience was that I wasn't willing to do what is required for recovery from alcoholism, required to bring about this spiritual experience that needs to, you know, that I says you may be suffering. So it's like these questions. Am I suffering now? Was my friend that I got the phone call from the night before I came here suffering from a condition that only a spiritual experience will conquer? Have I come to this retreat this weekend suffering from a spiritual condition that only a spiritual experience will conquer? We don't know. It says probably, maybe, if, when. That's like, that is so perfect, you know, because alcoholics will not be told what to do. You can't do it. You can't force this deal. Somebody told me in early sobriety, and I don't know how long this has been around AA, but one of the great truths in Alcoholics Anonymous is this. They're not ready until they're ready. And if somebody's ready, I can't say the wrong thing. And if somebody's not ready, I can't say the right thing. I've sat and taken people through this book and given them everything, making sure I didn't leave anything out. Every little piece that was given to me all the way along, and they didn't have an experience, and they didn't, you know, they didn't finish the steps, they didn't finish the amends, they didn't go out and work with others. They just didn't have the same experience I had. They weren't ready. So you're ready, you know, and only, I think that the only way that we know when we're ready is when this is an attractive thing to us. You know, when it said that only an illness or a spiritual experience will conquer, for me, you know, I wanted that. I could see that these guys that I went through this workshop with were really on fire with the program. And there was something about this camaraderie that they had and this happiness that they had, and they were guys that joked a lot and laughed a lot, and there was just something about them. And they said, you know, that what had happened to them is that they'd had this experience of working the steps that had brought this about in their life. And I'd listened to them enough to kind of come to terms that, you know, when I first came to AA, you all looked so clean cut and nice. And I just thought, and that's why, you know, I think I ended up at the kind of hall I did. There was people there that looked more like I did at that hall. You know, I just thought, man, these people can't possibly have been where I've been. You know, I just couldn't really believe it. But after listening to those guys' story in that workshop, listening to them for a few weeks, I was convinced pretty early on that these were guys that knew all about the drinking game. I was convinced of it. They didn't look like it from the outside, but when I listened to what they had to say, I thought, wow, man, these guys really were where I was. So I think that's kind of a good place to end for the night. Tomorrow morning, what we'll do, we're going to come back and we're going to look at the second step. We'll start with another little meditation. We'll do a little prayer. We'll do the second step. We're going to kind of go through We Agnostics for a little bit. We will actually do a third step prayer together for those of you that want to. And I'll do about a 15-minute meditation before we do that. Tomorrow with instructions and everything. So hopefully you can all make it back tomorrow. I know that not everybody's staying here at the retreat, but before we end, is there any more questions or comments from anybody before we close? Yeah, please. I think you just turned that on and you should be going.
Could Tom, an alcoholic.
Hey, Tom.
Could you comment on the idea of an acute alcoholic versus a chronic alcoholic, if that means anything to you?
You know, I mean, I look at what the big book has to say when it comes to alcoholism. And they do describe, I mean, you know, this program was set out for a particular type of alcoholic. Dr. Silkworth does call them the chronic type. He calls them the type with whom all other methods have failed. He calls them the hopeless type. And this is the type of alcoholic that this program is really made for, is I mean, people who are not, and the reason I guess I'm struggling with that question is I don't concern myself with that too much, with who is in AA and who isn't in AA. I know it's a little bit of a controversial thing. I am fully aware that there's people in AA who are not alcoholics. I'm even more fully aware that there's people in AA that are not the type of alcoholic that I am, this hopeless type. I mean, I diagnosed myself, and it was just my experience abundantly confirmed that I was this hopeless type alcoholic. So I am fond of saying this, and I don't know if this is getting to the core of your question, but I am really fond of saying this, and this is that the terms are different for different people that come into AA. And I don't like to carry it much further than that, but the terms are different. And what I mean by that is that there are people that come into Alcoholics Anonymous. It's been my experience. And again, I'm not pointing fingers or saying right or wrong or anything else. It's just my experience. There's people that come into Alcoholics Anonymous and they seem to be able to stay sober and have relatively happy lives. I've actually seen it. I would like to believe it wasn't so. I'd like to just believe anybody that doesn't work the steps is miserable. But there's people that come into Alcoholics Anonymous. They have relatively happy lives and they maintain long-term sobriety without doing the things that I do. You know, and I've even looked at it even further than that. That I'm the type whom half measures availed me nothing. You know, I'm that type of alcoholic. There's a place in How It Works that says that, you know, there's these type of people who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. And that's me. I'm a guy whose chances are less than average. You know, I do not have the same chance of staying sober as the average guy that comes into AA. And I believe that to my core. So with that, I don't worry about all the rest of that stuff. I know what I need to do to stay sober. I carry that message to people. The message that I carry is only attractive to a certain type of alcoholic. The guys that tend to come to me for sponsorship are hopeless. I don't get too many guys that come to me and are not. You know, the people that are tend to be attracted to my message are the last gaspers. You know, the guys that have been in and out of AA, and they just can't seem to stay sober, and they come and do this work. So I don't know if that, but I, you know, if you've got more to add to that, I'd be welcoming your comments. But I don't know if that. But the terms are not different for every. The terms are not the same for everybody that comes to AA. The one spectrum is the guy that just goes to meetings. He hangs out in the fellowship. And he stays sober and has a relatively good life. Might even have a pretty good story. Might be a guy that gets up and tells a great story and everybody laughs and it's a great time. But he's not doing steps. He's not doing what I'm doing to stay sober. That's one end of the spectrum. Guys that just come in and they're easily able to just set aside alcohol and they like life in AA and they stay sober. Don't do anything more than that. Not really making an effort at living the spiritual life. There's that extreme. The other end of that spectrum is the guy that comes into AA and he gets a home group, and he gets a service position, and he gets a sponsor. And he starts in the big book, and he's solid in the circle and triangle. And he does all this. He gets down on his knees, and he does a third step, and he writes the inventory. He does a fifth step, and he has a huge experience in five. And he comes out of that, and he starts making amends, and he quits making amends for a week, and he's drunk. And I've seen that kind of hopelessness. I've seen it over and over again. And I tend, for some reason, to think that I'm kind of on that side of the deal. And so I don't question really this deal about alcoholics or non-alcoholics or who's in AA or who's not. I know I am not very uniquely qualified to decide who gets to stay and who gets to go here. And so I'm better off as a guy that kind of worries about himself. So I do my deal. You know, I pray, I meditate, I work with others. I told Tom this the other day. A guy that I sponsor is just brand new. He's about brand new in sponsoring people. He's a year sober. He's been through the steps. He's just on to sponsor people. And he asked me, he said, well, what do you do when you're not sponsoring somebody, when you're not really working with somebody? Do you kind of go heavy on the other parts of the program? Do you kind of do more service work or something? And I thought about it. I told him, I don't know. I don't know what you do because, I mean, I'm clear what the terms are for me. I was a guy that I was told you got to give this away to keep it. And I'm not saying anything from a place of ego. It just is what it is. And I'm very grateful for it. But, you know, I've been doing this for 17 years. I've never, during that entire period of time, I've never not been working with a new guy. Never. I've always had somebody coming over. I've always been meeting with people. I've never, once in a while, I think I've got down to one a couple times, and I kind of panicked a little bit. Like, God, if he gets drunk, I'm in big trouble. So I've kind of gone to people, and I really like looking at it that way. It's been... I've come from the other extreme where I was really kind of concerned that there's people in AA that aren't alcoholics and don't have to do this, and there's non-alcoholics in the rooms. And I was really concerned about that at one time. And I think I've become less concerned about trying to diagnose the differences and stuff. I kind of share my experience with people, and it's attractive to a certain type of alcoholic, and it's not attractive to others. I mean, I get a lot of people that won't sit in a workshop like this and listen to this kind of stuff. They kind of think it's a little bit too much, you know. I mean, that's all right for you, but thank you very much for the information kind of stuff. So, yeah. Anybody else before we close? That was a long answer, wasn't it? Got me thinking about a couple things, though. Okay, well, I'm going to turn my mic off, and thank you guys for the night. Thank you. Okay, good morning, everybody. We're back. Running again. Good morning. Once again, my name's Kenny. I'm an alcoholic, and welcome to our 12-step weekend spiritual retreat. And I'm very grateful to be here. And I think we've probably added a few people from last night And I think it'll kind of build through the day here. So as people come in, we'll just help to just kind of direct them into taking a seat. We're going to start this morning with a couple of minutes of meditation. We'll take care of a couple of quick things. For one, we were looking at Bill's story last night, and I had this mention about Goose Hung High. And Audrey was kind enough to come up with a description for or a definition for us. And it says, to have a goose to hang high in preparation for eating during this depression era was a sign of having good fortune or wealth. So there you are. You hang the goose high to show that you're going to have plenty of food to eat. That means things are going good. So it's a depression era saying, which is kind of about, I think, what we imagine. But we will start this morning with a couple of minutes of just silent meditation. And we're going to kind of build on the meditations this weekend. We'll probably try to do 1 or 2 minutes of silent meditation before each session. So, is there anybody here that's never done meditation before, ever? So, well, that's good. So you're all kind of meditating people. And that's a good thing. You know, in Alcoholics Anonymous, it's actually a part and parcel of our 12 steps is this idea of prayer and meditation. And we'll do a lot more work around that when we get to the 11th step. But my experience in sponsorship is that as soon as I have an indication, and they actually talk about that in step 12, they talk about at the very first meeting, you know, we're to get an idea of, or even before the first meeting, if we can, if we are fortunate enough to have somebody who is close to the alcoholic that we can talk to get an idea of these kinds of things. One of the things they say we get an idea of is a person's religious leanings. And it's very important. And as soon as I have an idea if a person has some kind of a belief, the steps are in order for a reason. You know, it's you know, I think that we will not have the power to write inventory until we've done a third step, and you really aren't adequately going to make a decision to turn your will and your life over to this power greater than yourself if you haven't had this experience of coming to believe in something in step two. So the steps kind of go that way. It's really difficult to do a fifth step until you've really sat and done the pencil on paper work in step four. So the steps go like that. But one step that I have personal experience of starting to work very early in sobriety is this idea of seeking through prayer and meditation, this conscious contact with God. And so I will take people to 86 and 87 early on in the steps. If people are coming to my house and we're going through the book and I see they're having a really difficult time, I will take people to that place. And we're going to kind of leave the first step behind here this morning. We're going to look at steps two and three this morning. You know, that idea of starting to introduce people to prayer and meditation early on, I said, was my own experience. There was a guy that was around the hall when I was in really early sobriety, and I was going absolutely nuts. I mean, you know, I was like, my guts were just like in a, you know, just twisted in a, and I couldn't get a deep breath, and I was staying awake all night long. I mean, not sleeping at all, sober, and just, you know, I was just going out of my mind, and I just thought, well, and I just had all this tension in my face, you know. I mean, I just was, you know, I mean, I was ready for a drink. And I knew this one guy that every time they called on him in the meetings, he always talked about spirituality. And most people kind of thought he was a little nuts. And I think maybe I did it too at the time. But I have come to realize that there's a lot of stuff going on in the spiritual life that I hadn't accounted for before. And this is, anyways, this guy, he would talk about all kinds of stuff. And he had these teachers in India that he had traveled and seen, and now he said he didn't even need to travel to see him because he communicated with these cats telepathically, and he would go into meditation for 10 days at a time, and he said when he went into meditation for a long enough period of time that he could walk through walls, and this was the guy, the first guy that I ever sought out for spiritual advice in the program. I thought, well, God, if he's walking through walls and stuff, he must be able to help me, you know, calm down for a little bit. And so I went to him and I asked him, and he gave me some really, really simple instructions for meditation. I think everybody here's, we didn't have anybody raise their hands that has not ever done meditation, but you'd be surprised. I do a lot of workshops. I do these workshops in Seattle where we take groups of people through the steps at a time. And like I think I talked about those a little yesterday, the last 6 or 8 months, and we'll get through, you know, all the way through the whole book in that time, meeting once a week, and we'll go through all 12 steps as a group. And during those times, it's not unusual that I have a pretty good contingency of people that have never done meditation. So I offer them the same advice that this guy offered me in early sobriety, and I just went up and I said, listen, I'm going out of my mind here, and I'm wondering about maybe this meditation would help calm me down a little bit, and I don't really know how to do meditation. And he gave me some good practical advice. You know, he gave me this idea of just getting quiet and concentrating on your breath. Just try to breathe in and breathe out. And that was really a great meditation for me in early sobriety. And he said, every time my mind starts to wander, don't worry about it. Just recognize it for what it is. Just like if a car was to pass down a street, I could say, okay, well, that's this kind of car, or that's so-and-so, and I recognize it. And then I see it go away, but I don't think about it for any longer than that. And when I recognize that anything is distracting me from my meditation, I just bring it back to the breath. I don't get disturbed about it. We remember that this is a practice. And so as we're doing some meditations this week, and if you find that you're getting distracted or you don't feel like you're really solidly doing the meditation, the important thing to remember is that we're just practicing here. And it takes a long, long time to get to a place where you can be quiet for 20 minutes or get quiet for an hour. It takes years of practice for most people just to get to that place. And I was that way in early sobriety. I would go back and I would try to do this thing that he'd showed me, and I would get quiet. And then next thing I knew, I didn't even realize there was a... I'd be up making a bologna sandwich or something, you know, and I'm thinking, oh, geez, I was supposed to be meditating, or I'd be over making a phone call, or I'd be thinking about work, or, you know, I mean, it was It was impossible. It was absolutely impossible for me to get quiet for 30. It was absolutely impossible for me when I was in early sobriety to get quiet for 30 seconds. So I certainly don't expect that more than that out of the people that I sponsor, but I do suggest early on that they try some of these techniques. Another thing that, and this guy's name was Ken as well, another thing that Ken told me was that he said it helps to have a mantra. And you know, as you're concentrating on the breathing, if you kind of lose track of that, just go to your mantra. And he said, "Thy will be done" is a mantra that's used in all religions in one form or another. Not my will, thy will be done. And he said, you can shorten that to "thy will be done." And then he said, you can even shorten that just to "thy will." And then anytime you're distracted, just bring it back to your mantra. Another thing that he taught me about was he taught me about a focal point, which means that when you close your eyes in your mind's eye, which is what you see when you're closing your eyes and concentrating on your breath, that it's helpful for some people to bring into their mind their guru, their savior, their spiritual teacher. And I didn't really know what any of these cats looked like that Ken was talking about. So there was one particular person that I did know what that person looked like. I thought I'd seen some paintings and stuff in childhood of this guy. And I tried that, and it didn't really come to me much. But what did come to me when I was doing that was just kind of the bright light. I could just kind of focus on a small bright light, and I could just focus on that getting brighter and brighter as I was doing my meditations. And that was silent meditation. Another good piece of advice that came to me a lot later on is I was taught to sit a certain way in meditation where I was sitting straight up and keeping my spine straight, and that this was very important to bring these centers together. And I had difficulty with that in some respects because I was really out of shape. That's probably the biggest reason. But and a guy gave me some advice years later, and he said, no, really the idea is just to find your seat. That for Westerners that are used to using the backs on their chairs, sometimes these positions aren't very comfortable. And so he just said, find your seat. And that was great advice for me as well. Just find your seat in meditation. Just find a position that's comfortable for you. Find a chair that's comfortable for you. And then use that in your meditation with these things. So with that, we won't go back to that again. We'll do a little silent meditation maybe before each session, 1 or 2 minutes. I'll bring us out of that with a prayer. I brought this chime like that I said I would yesterday, and you can see that some props have been added up here, and I really appreciate that. And I will say about all of these, somebody smudged this room this morning. I don't know if anybody can smell the sage, but somebody came and smudged the room this morning. I don't know who was that. Maybe it was, Oh, Janice, thank you so much for smudging the room. And I burn sage at my house, and it does kind of have a smell that can be, people sometimes smell that burning sage and think that it's marijuana. And one time I was burning sage, and my little daughter came up, and she said, that smells like Sonia's house, she said. And I was like, oh, geez, I mean, maybe I don't want you going to Sonia's house anymore. So that's what that smell is. That smell is sage, and it's meant to purify. We've got somebody's been kind enough to bring a candle up here and light a candle for me, and I really, really appreciate that. I do the same thing. We burn a lot of candles in my house. We burn sage, and I have essential oils I burn, and I do a lot of these things. So I have pictures on my wall of I've got a picture of Bill Wilson on my wall. I've got a picture of Mother Teresa on my wall. I've got a picture of Gandhi on my wall. I've got a picture of Bill and Ebby together on my wall. And I've got a picture of the man in the bed on my wall in my office where I work with new guys. And none of those things bring about the presence of God, but they remind me of the presence of God, and they remind me about this. The reason I have those particular people is because AA is really, truly is, and we'll get there to the 12th step on Sunday, but it really, truly is recovery through self-sacrifice and service to others, and it's not a new idea. But it seems to work very well for alcoholics to get outside of themselves. So I use these props like this, and I like them. The chime is the same thing. I'll get back on our topic here. The chime this was a gift from my wife. This chime is something that's meant to get our attention. You ring the chime. You'll notice if you get quiet that you can hear the chime ringing for a long time into your meditation. They actually have chimes like this, much bigger ones, you know, they'll have all the way up to the big gongs and stuff that you'll see in temples sometimes. And they've got these chimes that will ring for 20 or 30 minutes. So these people know when the sound of the chime is done that they're done with their morning meditation, for instance. So this will ring. I think you will be able to hear this for a minute or so, but it just kind of gives us it's a good practice. And then I'll ring it again when we're coming out of meditation. And we'll do 2 minutes this morning just to kind of get us started. And I'll bring us out of that with the prayer, and then we'll get started on our step two here. So. Heavenly Father, Mother and Child, Lord of the happy, joyous, and free, we thank you for your presence here with us this weekend. And as we go forward here in this practice of the 12 steps, we'd ask that you would be our guide. We'd ask that you would guide our thoughts and our actions, and especially our words. We'd ask that this retreat this weekend be allowed to fill us with your love, and that love would overflow from us into the lives of many people. Amen. Okay, We are on step two. We'll give you a little bit of a vision of where we're headed here today. There'll be a little bit of group conscience involved here. We're going to do two sessions. We'll do one session here this morning, and we'll cover step two. We'll try to get up to step three here before we take a break. We'll cover that probably pretty quickly. I do want to clarify once again that, you know, we are not working the steps here. You know, what we are doing is trying to encourage the people that come to this workshop to work the steps and encourage people that are coming to this retreat to search diligently within themselves and to think honestly. So we'll move rather quickly, and I like to clarify that. If I was working one-on-one with somebody or if I was doing one of these workshops, you know, we would be looking at every single paragraph and everything, doing the entire book. And you just can't do that in these weekend retreats. So we're doing the next best thing. And we ended up last night kind of covering the first step. And now we're at this place in We Agnostics. We left off on page 44 in We Agnostics. And if you have your book, you can follow along. And if you don't, that's okay too. We're not going to try to do too much direct reading and quoting out of the book. We're going to do these two sessions this morning up to steps two and three. We'll come back. When we come back for this next session, we'll actually try to do a third step as a group. And I'm not sure how that'll work in this configuration, but we'll figure that out at the break. But we'll do a third step for those who wish to participate. We'll do a little music. We'll do a little longer meditation. We'll get down on our knees. We'll do a third step prayer for those of you that want to have that experience with us this weekend. We'll come out of that experience. We'll talk about four and five a little bit. And when we come back after lunch, I think we'll come back around 1:30 or something. And we'll announce the times all the way along in case I don't get this quite right. But we'll come back. We'll do a couple sessions. We'll do a session 1:30, two or three sessions before dinner. 5:30 will end. And that's where the group conscience part comes in. We could have another session after dinner if the group at that time wants it. But a lot of times, there's so much information at these retreats. We need time to process everything, too. It's just, it can become absolutely overwhelming sometimes, the amount of stuff that you get here. With that, I did kind of hit us with a letter last night from my mother right off, and I thought I'd do something a little funner this morning before we really get into this serious stuff. And, you know, this step two is such a great thing. The idea here is that sober, we can take a look at this. You know, and I think we kind of had a show of hands last night, but we have a lot of people here that are either... They are currently working the steps, or they have worked the steps and are currently working with others. And that constitutes almost everybody that was here, at least at last night's meeting. So, you know, we could come from this point of looking at this from a newcomer's perspective in this come-to-believe idea, or we can look at this from an experience of, for those of us that have been in the program for a while, in this We Agnostics, that I can still go back and find areas of my life that I am agnostically inclined, and they talk about that in here, those of us that are agnostically inclined. And I need to continuously go back and look at that I may say I believe in God, I may say that I have this power greater than myself in my life, but if you hang out with me, you might say, well, Kenny, you know, it looks like you're pretty fully in control of the financial situation here, and you don't have it doesn't seem to me like you're operating a lot of faith in that area, or you might not be operating a lot of faith where it comes to these talks that you have with your daughter, for instance. You know, I mean, it's interesting that, and this thought just came to me just recently that where, and Shannon and I have talked about this, where our daughter's concerned. I have a 15-year-old daughter. And she's kind of coming out of this phase, thank goodness. But she was like dressing in all black, dyeing her hair black. You know, she wanted to get a mohawk. I mean, this was, you know, I was just kind of like, oh wow, here it comes. But she's a great, great, great kid. And I try to convince her that, you know, you've got to live life this certain way. You know, you're going to have to do this. You're going to have to get good grades. You're going to have to go to college, and, you know, you need college to get the good, you know, job. I've got all this stuff, and I'm doing that out of love, but at the same time, my experience is the only God that I know, and I know no other God, is a God that will let you royally screw up your life, and it's still okay. But I don't want my daughter knowing about that God. So that's agnosticism. That's agnosticism. So in my life, you know, I am afraid to share with her the God that I know, the God that really loves you no matter what you do, that it doesn't matter if you screw up, that you know, things will still work out so long as you do some things. Because there is that fear, of course. We all have seen the other end of that too. So I said I'd start out with something real funny and today. This is kind of related to the 12th step. So I'm bouncing around a little bit, but it just came to me. I wanted to get this in and not forget to look at this. But when I'm sponsoring somebody, we're going through the work, and we talked about this yesterday. You know, this whole deal is really about 12. It doesn't ever, you know, no matter how many times you work the steps, it doesn't ever end up anywhere but reaching your hand out to a still suffering alcoholic. That's the whole deal. All the rest of this is to enable us to be in fit spiritual condition when people come to us. And my life depends on people showing up. So I don't take it personally with people that I sponsor. I try not to. But when I sponsor people, we set some ground rules. And I'm really probably kind of a little conservative on that end of the sobriety spectrum when it comes to sponsoring people. You know, I will tell you that if you don't show up, you know, I'm not going to sponsor you. And if you don't show up a few times to my house, I find somebody else to fill that spot. And it's not a personal thing. And I what I mean by that is I bring people to my home, and I live in a really Niles has been to my house, and you know, I live in a really beautiful home today, and I've got a beautiful wife, and we've got two great kids, and you know, I've got this. So I like to bring people to my house because then I let them know that this isn't a personal thing. These rules that I set down, that if you don't show up, my life depends on working with alcoholics. I have to be shoulder to shoulder with people in this work. So I got to get people through the steps that are going to work on this with me, that are going to go out and sponsor other people. And if you're not showing up, you know, it's, and I just tell them that, you know, if I drink, I will lose everything. You know, I'll lose this house, I'll lose my wife, I'll lose my job, I'll lose everything here. So you got to show up. And if you don't, I'm sorry, but I'm going to bring somebody in that will. You know, my life depends on having people that are showing up at my house on a regular basis. So in that respect, I had a sponsee. It was a roommate of Niles at one time, actually. And I had a sponsee that couldn't show up. And he was really worried. He's like, oh, my God, I haven't showed up a couple weeks in a row, and Kenny's going to fire me. And he was in the middle of his inventory. And I was kind of considering that. Hey, this guy hasn't showed up. You better show up. So he shows up this week, and he has an excuse letter. He said, hey, I know I didn't show up. But he says, I brought a letter with me. And so I was like, well, okay, Joe, I got to see this. So Joe gives me this letter. It's dated August 5th of 2004. It says, Dear Ken, please excuse Joe Kaiser, your second favorite sponsee, from his sponsor-required fourth step progress. Normal progress has been hindered by a combination of circumstances and events beyond his human aid. As you know, Joe has been in recent financial hardships. Unfortunately, his sponsor, who is financially secure, is not familiar with the end of page 96. So if you look at page 96, it says, he may be broke and homeless. If he is, you might try to help him about getting a job or give him a little financial assistance.